Just a moment. Just a moment.
Welcome to the Future Law Podcast, exploring where the law has been.
Hey Siri, take a selfie.
And where it's going.
Oh, good afternoon.
From the brilliant.
My name is Sophia, and I am the latest and greatest robot.
To the scary.
Just what do you think you're doing, Dave?
And everything in between. Please welcome your very real and very human host, Mike Madison.
Hello, and welcome to the Future Law Podcast, where we cut through the noise and get to the gist of legal education, the legal profession, legal technology, and legal innovation. I'm your host today, Michael Madison, law professor at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I'm joined today by my friend, Dan Rodriguez. Dan is has a long career in legal education in the U.S. He most recently served as the dean of the law school at Northwestern University. He served a term as the president of the Association of American Law Schools. He previously served on the faculties of the University of Texas, the University of San Diego, where he was also the dean for a time, and started his law professor career at University of California, Berkeley. His academic specialty is administrative law, but we're going to talk today about what he's doing presently and looking ahead. Welcome, Dan.
Thanks. Glad to be here, Michael.
So, Dan, could you tell us just a little bit about sort of your connections these days to legal innovation, legal technology, and related things? Sort of what drew you to those areas in light of a long and successful career in legal academia?
Well, thank you for saying it was successful. It certainly was long. and what draws my interest these days really goes back to those days in some important respects. I've had a blessed career, and it's been about a quarter century, half of which has been as a civilian law professor. That's a wonderful career, as I don't need to tell you. And about half has been as an academic administrator at two terrific law schools at different times in my career. And I'd say particularly the second tour of duty, as it were, that is my time at Northwestern as I began that deanship in 2012. My interests blossomed in innovation, legal innovation in legal education. As you mentioned, that coincided with my work in the Association of American Law Schools, also works in the profession. I say that not to recite my resume, which you did a wonderful job of doing, but just to say that as I came to Northwestern, which was during 2012, a fairly turbulent time for certainly American legal education, it dawned on me, as it did so many others, we had a lot of work to do ahead of us, not only at our law school, but in law schools around the country and indeed around the globe, to respond to a number of imperatives that really were calling on us to innovate, to iterate, to experiment, and to really, in some fundamental way, change our ways of doing business. So I find that energizing and made whatever small contributions, continue to make whatever small contributions I can to those efforts.
So, to a lot of people who are practicing lawyers, law firm managers, entrepreneurs, legal tech developers, and investors, there's a lot of activity, a lot of investment, a lot of energy around innovation in the legal system. And a lot of those folks look at law schools and say, why aren't you more aggressively with the program? Why aren't you modernizing your curricula? Why aren't you hiring different faculty? Why aren't you training new graduates to be more engaged and prepared to participate in the modern legal services marketplace? So maybe you could talk to a little bit about both the constraints and the opportunities that law schools in particular face today.
Well, they're right to note that. And in no particular order, actually, I begin with a defensive comment that I'll just mention and then pass by. They'll be happy to talk about it more. It's defensive sounding. It's not meant to be. And that is, there actually is more innovation going on in legal education than meets the eye. If it's on us as legal educators in our law schools in the U.S. and abroad to explain and really not to disclose, because it's not a secret, but to articulate what we're actually doing to adapt in important ways, then we need to do a better job of doing that because there are things going on. Now, moving away from the defensive part, though, there's so much innovation and work still left to do. I would say the principal constraints, which to get to your question, they are internal and external. The external getting, I think, more oxygen than it probably deserves, quite frankly. The external constraints are regulation, accreditation standards. In the United States, certainly U.S. News and World Report rankings, but those are not entirely unique to the U.S. Law schools in other parts of the world get ranked as well. And so we are enormously responsive and reactive in legal education. And in the case of regulatory standards, appropriately responsive to regulations that impose in various ways constraints on innovation. But that's not the whole story. The internal part, the internal constraints that can often come across as excuses, not entirely wrongly, have to do with a kind of a miasma of issues. Certainly our expectations of how we hire and promote faculty in our workforce, as it were, is a key part of that constraint. Universities, most, not all, but most law schools are parts of universities, which are, as you know, complex enterprises and impose demands and expectations on law schools. I'm not going to go through the whole list. I'll simply summarize it by saying there are a number of internal constraints that that can and have over a long period of time effectively cabined and constrained innovation. And what that's left is, and I hope we can talk more about this, is what I would call somewhat opaquely culture. And that is just the way of doing business, the way we think about operating and functioning in law schools that is reflected our own kind of internal limits on our ability and willingness to innovate.
So you invited the question. Let me just redirect it right back. So let's talk about culture. So what aspects of legal education culture, higher education culture, legal profession culture? What do you have in mind specifically when you point to that as a potential issue?
All right. So here's a nasty secret, but it's not much of a secret, and I'm not sure it's particularly nasty. And that is, life as a full-time faculty member is a pretty good life, pretty good professional life. The kinds of control that one has over their own time to engage in deep thoughts or not so deep thoughts, scholarship, the teaching burdens are by no means trivial, but they can be light when compared to not only others in the academic world who don't have that luxury, but certainly those in the professional world. So we can get, and we, the professoriate, again, in the U.S. and elsewhere, can rest on our laurels and not have incredible incentives to change. For the most part, students, and this relates to culture, students in law schools do not shop around, that is, make their decisions of which law schools to go to based on considerations about the quality and measure of teaching, the experience, professional experience, experiences of the faculty, and other issues that are needles that can be moved in important ways, which would, of course, create incentives to change in significant respects. Instead, they make their decisions, and this is not meant as a criticism. It's an observation about student choice and human behavior on the basis of the prestige of the law school, its reputation, and in the case of the U.S., the baleful influence of this U.S. News and World Rankings and its attempted effort to, you know, create a sort of ordinal ranking of schools, location, not so much price, because law schools, again, maybe this is a nasty secret again, is American law schools are all very expensive to a greater or lesser degree. So the culture, to come back to your question, is to engage in our work as teachers and as scholars in a way that for some of us is self-indulgently, but I'll put it in a more neutral ways, is a way that reflects our own choices over our own time and our judgments about what we should do vis-a-vis our students. Very little attention is paid to how we're servicing, right, the profession by our construction of our educational models and our teaching of our students. There are certainly exceptions to that, so let me be clear about that. But the overall culture is still one that I think incentivizes a great amount of complacency.
Your story reminds me of a quick conversation I had with a colleague of mine at Pittsburgh maybe 15 years ago, where some of us who had long experience in the private sector before becoming academics could see market forces starting to catch up with the way law schools were running themselves. And I said to a colleague, and quite a bit senior to me at the time, that, you know, law schools should be sort of worried about market forces and competition in various respects. And his response to me was, we're a law school. We have no competition. So right. I've always remembered that, not in a good way. So no. Let me follow up your cultural description by wondering aloud and asking you to comment on whether the cultural trends in legal education in the U.S. are so deeply rooted that it's essentially impossible to reform them from within, at least in a short term time frame. And instead, should we be looking to forms of sort of competition, sort of legal education and legal services training coming from other sectors outside of law schools, outside of the university?
Well, if you'll permit me to reframe the question, I'll address the second part before I do the first. We should be looking at models of competition, and I'll come back to that more concretely. But I think they're deeply embedded and deeply rooted, but they're not. It's not impossible to change. And just to focus for a moment on the internal before shifting to the external part, competition and all that. Internal culture is resilient. But it can be supple and need not be permanent. So, for example, if the culture is as it certainly is made up in no small part because of the expectations and the training in the background of the faculty, faculty members, of course, age out inevitably. And so newer generations of faculty members can and ought to come in with different expectations and different trajectories. And I think that's starting to happen. Without at the risk of putting too much weight on the significance of deans, I can't really help it because that's where I've been for so much of my career. I think innovative and imaginative deans with their own projects, their projects being to really destabilize some of the cultural factors and to work on fomenting change. Some of them will try and be short lasting. Others will try and be able to walk away pointing to some successes. Maybe not as much as they had hoped. I think I fall into that category. And third, some might actually find bottled lightning and really act to work in ways that are fundamentally transformative. So there's lots more to say, but let me just say that these deep roots can be excavated and implanted in more fallow fields, if I can strain that metaphor to its breaking point. The point about competition, though, is a really good one, and I'm glad you raised it. The competition is coming from all places. And because I know that some of the avid listeners of your wonderful podcast are from outside the United States, let me take a moment to step outside of U.S. terra firma and say that we are facing, and I think this is happy circumstance, competition from law schools abroad. Now, you know, in a narrow sense, maybe for only some of our students, graduate students, LLM students and the like, which affects, of course, the economic and bottom line. But I think the more interesting what I find and I know you find interesting is the competition that comes from experimentation and innovation from other countries, from the UK and Australia, whose law schools have innovated in some really interesting and important ways. Some parts of Asia, what's going on in Singapore, which I tend to look at fairly closely these days, is really interesting and imaginative. Canada, Germany, that's an incomplete list. But when I began my academic career, let me assure you, the most of the attention that we paid in American legal education to other countries was just trying to take the temperature of those countries and figure out how quickly they would adapt and embrace American models of legal education rather than the reverse.
So how much of what you're describing, the experimentalism that you're observing in other countries in addition to the U.S., how much of that is due to what you perceive of sort of different legal cultures, different trajectories of the profession in those places? How much of that is just the global spread of sort of technology development and how the ways in which technological changes, new platforms, new models of legal delivery, different regulatory systems for lawyers, how much of that is sort of related to cultural factors? How much of it is related to sort of technology and structural factors?
So there's too much there in your question to possibly get out except at the surface. So I'm going to cherry pick a little bit and mention a couple, if you'll permit me. So first, let me mention regulation. One of the very fascinating phenomena that's happening in many parts of the globe, as you know, is regulatory change and the destabilization of of extant regulation. So let me just pick on one country or note one country, and that's the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom, remarkably, Americans that don't pay too much attention to comparative legal education are amazed when I point this out. Because of changes in the solicitor's regulatory authority regime in their version of state bars in the UK, you can actually qualify and sit for the bar having studied at the undergraduate level, not even the law. Now, there's more than meets the eye, but that's been a significant regulatory change, and it'll be years until we see what the exact outcome has been. And there have been some other regulatory innovations as well. So that's an example. In Australia, as you know, there's been some really interesting experiments. There are interesting experiments underway with the adoption of the JD degree, and I wouldn't say the move toward, because there, of course, the undergraduate degree in law still reigns supreme, but the consideration of a postgraduate JD legal education, which is an adoption of the American model, but of course for their own system, is an example of trying something out that's very new and looking at that as a possibility. Let's face it, they meaning some other countries, I mentioned again Australia as an example, have adopted some different schemes and mechanisms of legal education. We have been rather slow off the mark in the United States. So, you know, for 50 years or so, folks have blasted away at the U.S. from abroad, saying, well, why does law have to be a one-size-fits-all three-year postgraduate degree? Why don't you adopt the models from other countries? And most of our answer has been cultural. Well, this is the way we do things, and also regulatory. The ABA won't let us. So adaptation in the U.S. comes much more slowly. I'll stop rambling, except to make this one other quick point. You mentioned technology. Certainly, technology, the availability of technology and its rapid rise in significance in legal practice and business practice has played a destabilizing role in business as usual, not only in legal education, of course, but in higher education.
So let me follow up on the technology question then, because I know that from my own experience at Pittsburgh, this is a space where our baseline legal education program at Pitt is sort of fundamentally unchanged, meaning the core backbone of the three-year JD remains essentially the same today as it was 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago.
In common, I'll interrupt in saying, with every other law school, essentially. Lest this be about Pitt.
Right. No, I absolutely want to acknowledge and actually endorse the, we're sort of representative in that respect, right? The pressure to change the program has not come from the bar or the cohort of employers so much as it has started to emerge from the students themselves. So you mentioned earlier that law students applying to U.S. law schools don't typically select among law schools based on all kinds of things that you might ordinarily expect purchasers of expensive services to select for. Instead, they're largely driven by sort of reputational considerations, and then to a considerable degree now, cost considerations. But once they come in the door, our students increasingly come to me and to a handful of other colleagues at my school who are interested in law and technology topics in various respects, and basically say, why aren't we doing more of this? Why isn't Pitt offering more courses, more coursework, more experiential opportunities, whether that's clinics or externships or part-time work kinds of things that prepare them to understand the suites of technology tools, analytics, AI, big data, that are clearly part and parcel of professional services. So what other than the cultural stuff, one thing that I observe in my own university is that there are sort of these structural barriers to including that kind of material easily in a law school curriculum, because our faculty aren't trained to do that. The people who are trained live in computer science departments or engineering schools or information science schools or business schools. And collaborating with those people, it can be very, very awkward and difficult just from an administrative standpoint. So the question is, you were a dean. Most recently at a leading law school in Chicago, at Northwestern University. So there's the role of the leader in this situation. You've got an existing culture. You've got some organizational barriers. You've got increasing demand among the community of people that you serve, primarily the students. What kinds of things, if you were to counsel a dean or you were at a council of department chair or a division head in a country that doesn't have a dean of a professional law school. What kinds of things could you do to sort of move these kinds of collaborations, these kinds of integrations forward more quickly?
Well, I would say I was going to use the metaphor of drink the Kool-Aid, but that has an unfortunate resonance. So let me shift the metaphor to come on in, the water's fine. That is one thing I would certainly say is innovation, in particular multidisciplinary innovation, which is what you put your finger on so aptly, is happening. It's well underway. It's further along in some other fields than it is in law. It's further along in the legal profession than it is in the academic profession. But this is again an idea whose time has come. So I would urge that those incoming deans or department heads to make it a priority. We would have to have full understanding of exactly the point you raised, which are the challenges and the obstacles that exist within the university setting. I'll tell you a very, very quick story, which is when we developed at the law school an interdisciplinary program that involved the marriage of law, business, and technology in what I thought was just an enormously multidisciplinary way. I got a call from the then dean of the business school who said, you know, we run business education here at the university. So when you're involving in a business, you're sort of stepping on our turf. So that's an obstacle, right? And that story could probably be told at a lot of universities. So it's very important, just to give practical advice, it's very important for an incoming dean or department head, whatever, to understand that insofar as they are part of a broad university, there will be some pitfalls and perils. But the future lies in multidisciplinary education. And in fact, I sometimes make this prediction. I'm not sure I stand by it by any high 100%, but I think in years to come, folks might look back at this era, both in the U.S. and elsewhere, and ask this question. Why is it you have law schools separated in silos from business schools, separated from public policy schools? I mean, aren't we all in these professional complex endeavors together? And that'll be a hard question to answer. It's a hard question to answer in 2020.
So that prompts me to ask a more immediate question. So we're recording this podcast in the summer of 2020. The COVID pandemic is still raging around the world, and at the ground level, higher universities, colleges, schools at all levels are in the middle of trying to figure out whether any parts of their educational programming can go back to a face-to-face model in the near future. I'm planning to teach all of my courses in the fall in a remote format.
Me too.
As are
Me
too. Many, many teachers and yeah. entire faculties and universities are doing that. So I'm wondering if you consistent with the sort of that multidisciplinary theme, law is not unique in the respect of needing to think ambitiously and creatively about how to migrate to a training modality, a training style that's not the classic, in the classroom for law, Socratic style interaction with students. What are the long-term implications of this? How do you think this may change professional education once the crisis of the pandemic is less urgent?
So I am I have medium-sized optimism in this regard compared to so many folks who I talk to, and I suspect you talk to. I think we have a terrible situation, to say the obvious, but that presents us with an opportunity in legal education, higher education across the world to make some tremendously disruptive changes, modalities of how we teach, the online issue, the changes and adaptations to our curriculum, what admissions testing, you go down the road. And indeed, regulators, focusing for a moment just on the U.S., although I suspect this is true abroad as well, are giving us more of a runway and more flexibility because of the emergency nature of this pandemic. So it is an enormous opportunity. But the reason I say, so we could make some really bold and, you never want to say permanent, but sustaining changes as a consequence of this, as we're finding is being talked about in other parts of the profession. Now, why medium-sized? Because I talk to so many folks, professional leaders and academic leaders, who basically say, I wish I was Rip Van Winkle. I wish I could just go to sleep for this period of time. And when there's a vaccine and it's over, wake up and then say, wow, we made the best adaptations for this emergency, but let's go back to where we were and then figure out whether we want to make adaptations. And I fear that's become quite common when folks talk about, we're all focused on the fall, right? As you say, when we're recording this now, what are we going to do in the fall? How are we going to open for business in the fall? Well, newsflash, the spring's not going to be any better, right? The academic challenges about how we teach and what we're going to do in 2021 are going to loom very large. So I'm not despondent, but I'm a tad cynical about the commitments of a lot of folks to make significantly disruptive change when they're just looking at their calendar, counting the days until, you know, Christmas and afterwards when 2021, hoping that they can just go back to normal. I don't want to go back to that normal. I hope there is a, I hate the phrase, but I hope there's a new normal. And that is, you know, that's one that has an enormous adaptation and an opportunity for change.
So let me ask you one final question today, which is to take that new normal perspective and sort of address students, both students who are thinking about going to law school or taking a law degree, students who are currently in law school anywhere and are confronted with sort of so much change, technological change, the urgency of adaptation to the current COVID crisis. There's so much happening out there. So if you were to sort of give us sort of a couple minutes of a sort of a macro set of guidelines, so things to prioritize, things to think about, things to do as you're entering the profession, how do you advise that community?
So what I would say to an audience of current law students, and also new graduates who, let's face it, are coming into the world in the midst of the pandemic, and also entering law students. I'll leave aside for a moment the ones who are thinking about whether to go to law school at all. If we have time, we'll come back to them. But in terms of that other audience, I would say have faith. We have your back. By and large, with very few exceptions, legal educators, deans, law schools are aware of the need to be student first and student focused. And although there are enormous challenges, pandemic challenges, challenges of racial injustice and racism, systemic racism, and everything that goes along with it, that higher education, legal education is committed to developing the kinds of models of preparation that will enable our graduates to thrive in the years to come. We may not always get it right, and we may end up experimenting, but this is not a time for complacency, and I don't see a lot of complacency. I see a lot of energy going to student well-being. One just very small anecdote is students who are just new graduates are facing enormous dilemmas in terms of studying and taking the bar exam. And although those issues still need to be resolved, I've been really encouraged by law professors and deans and others and professional leaders really going to bat for those students and understanding they need to really think about it. What I would say very briefly to students who are making up their minds, is law a career that I want to aspire to, and is this a good time to go to law school? I'd say yes. Yes, it is a glorious time and career to go to law school and a career to have, if law schools in the U.S. and abroad walk the walk of actually developing multidisciplinary practice-connected curricula and programs to enable them to thrive in a world of global and technological sophistication. And they should continue to be savvy consumers and look at law schools and make choices based on the capacity of schools to make those real changes and real adaptations. And I think we will. And then if I'm right, if we're right, then I think legal education is a wonderful pathway to a diversity of careers.
The one thing I would add to that, if you'll indulge me the privilege of supplementing what you just said, is that when I talk to prospective students and students coming into school, I universally advise them to look beyond the classic legal profession career pathways, that there is a long history, especially in the U.S., of people coming into law school and imagining that they're only sort of goal and destination, and the one that they should aspire to is a law firm job in a downtown business law firm.
Right. Although there are wonderful folks who've had wonderful careers doing exactly that, as you know, our students.
Which is not to disparage that in any respect. As you say, it can be a great career and a very rewarding career for a lot of people. But we've known, you and I both went to law school around the same time a while back, we've always known that there are many additional pathways to happiness and success and impact with a law degree, but they just don't have the cultural resonance. They don't have the cultural salience for a lot of people coming into law school, especially at the front end. So what I tell people these days, if they're coming into law school or thinking about going to law school, is to be very, very open and inclusive in imagining the multiplicity of pathways and opportunities. That it's not just that the law degree allows you to do many things, it's that the law degree connects in that multidisciplinary, multi-professional way to many, many other fields, whether that's business or engineering or social work or education or computer science or other things, that you can convert that kind of training and pathway into all kinds of really interesting and rewarding and impactful sort of career paths that would include, in for many people, law firms, private law firms, but and it also includes government service and criminal law on both prosecution and
defense. As you well know, I agree with that 100%. As you've also experienced, as I have, that can be a hard message to communicate. Because it runs up against the counter narrative that when you and I and others make that point, what we're essentially saying, without saying so explicitly, is you can settle for a career that is inferior to what your glamorous classmates' careers are if you if you don't get one of that brass ring. That's not the message. It's not the message as you just articulated it, and as we try to. But we have to really speak, and you just have. To how that message is the diversity of careers, not they're the good careers for which a JD is required, and then there's what happens if you don't get those jobs. That's not the message.
Exactly. And so you've just inspired me to add a mission to this podcast, which is to celebrate all of those additional pathways and opportunities in sort of affirming and positive ways, because I do think not only are they just rewarding for the people who move in those directions with their degrees, but they're actually really powerful and impactful ways to do the kinds of good in the world that people come to law school often intending to do.
Absolutely.
And I think that's one of the big lessons of the technology revolution, among other things, is that it really expands the possibilities for impact for legal services. Dan, I'll give you the last word. Any sort of last words of wisdom and messages for folks listening to the podcast?
Yeah, thank you. I'm happy to do that. And thanks for letting me have a chance to do that. So I've long thought and have been, both in my own career as a dean and leader of organizations, to think that if we're going to get substantial change in innovation in legal education around the world, it'll come from the top down. So in imaginative, bold deans and college presidents, leaders of the bar and all of that, if we just give them the opportunity and the right messages, they'll foment change. Over the years, I've come to be more skeptical of that and actually believe if we're going to see change, and I look at the example of folks protesting about the defund police movement and the George Floyd killing and many other things, I think the instability will come from pressure from the bottom up. And from the bottom up, if you'll permit me that metaphor, it's the students and it's consumers and others. So I'm less hopeful that we'll just the grand poobahs of all this, we'll just get it right and we'll create change. And I'm more hopeful that the movements, the public movements and the pressure and interest groups and even protests will help push and foment change. So keep pressure on us is what I would say to your listeners out there who really want change to happen.
Fabulous. Okay, well, we'll stop with that. Dan Rodriguez, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been the Future Law Podcast. This has been your host, Michael Madison. Thank you for joining us. You can find the Future Law Podcast online at thefuturelawpodcast.com and at your favorite podcast providers, Google, Apple, Spotify, Podbean, Stitcher, etc. Thanks to everyone for listening. Look forward to having you with us next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Future Law Podcast. For links to the articles mentioned and to contact the hosts, visit futurelawpodcast.com.